Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Sprague from Persimmon Health. I am a serial entrepreneur working on healthcare technology that helps more people access better quality of care. This podcast is for the movement of innovators, entrepreneurs, intrapreneurs, and thought leaders that are advancing the American healthcare system through digital health. In this podcast, we highlight real stories of innovators and enablers of digital health, their opportunities, challenges, and learnings for innovation. We'll cover topics such as startup building and fundraising, entrepreneurship, emerging technologies, and big ideas to transform healthcare. We invite you to participate in this community, share your stories, and accelerate the movement. Thank you. We have an awesome pod. Enjoy. Hello, digital health community. Today, I'm excited to have on Ken Mayer, founder and CEO of Safe Health Systems. That's at safehealth.me. Safe is operated in partnership with Mayo Clinic and offers a turnkey digital health platform that offers provider services, diagnostics, and interops with many EHRs out of the box. And this allows customers to deploy really targeted apps and population health programs within weeks instead of months or years. Ken, I think it's exciting that your platform comes with all of these parts included, and I'm eager to learn more about what it can do. Welcome to the pod. Would you mind telling us briefly about yourself?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for having us. I really appreciate it. So actually, my background was really in entertainment and marketing. Mm-hmm. I started while I was in college. I built a little entertainment magazine, kind of a small LA Weekly or Village Voice, and ended up selling that to Gannett when I was 19. And I was going to school in North Carolina, and I moved up to New York City and launched a production company. And about a year later, ended up getting a TV show on Fox. It was about the worst time slot on television, Friday nights at 12:30. There was about three people watching, but I got to spend my 20s tromping around the world, filming bands and having a good time living in New York City. In late 99, I transitioned into tech and launched a predecessor to YouTube called GTV. And it was, basically a platform that allowed people to upload videos and photos. You had what we called at the time a buddy list, because we were kind of drawing concepts from this messaging. And a wall, essentially, that we called message boards, where you could communicate with the people watching your content. But we launched it in the spring of 99, and it became so popular so quickly, we had to take it down about 9 months later after burning through $10 million in bandwidth.
Wow. Costs, okay.
Which hadn't been commoditized yet, and the infrastructure really wasn't there. I mean, to put it in context, YouTube launched 6 years later and burned through about $60 million in bandwidth costs before being acquired for over $1 billion. So not a bad return on investment, but I was like, in my mid 20s and had no idea how to raise $60 million. So
we ended up ahead of the time. Yeah,
it was. And we ended up pivoting and selling the company about 4 years later. We acquired a small company in South America that had a really sophisticated enterprise instant messaging platform. And at the time, you had a lot of businesses bringing IM to work. It was pre-texting on cell phones, and it was a big problem for the CIOs, and Sarbanes-Oxley and actually HIPAA had just come out, which required encrypting personal health information that was sent out over the web. And at the time, people were just attaching PDFs to emails, which was basically in violation of these new HIPAA regulations that not many people understood. So we had some big clients, a lot of payers that had sort of field offices that were sending claims forms over email. So we ended up selling out. I ended up selling out of that in 2006 and moved out to LA and was playing around in the movie business and had the opportunity really to get into what became Safe Health Systems about 4 years ago. So that's
got it. And what did inspire you to start Safe Health?
So originally, the concept was an app that let people show their verified STD status privately on their phone, and provided an easy and expensive way to get tested and treated. At the time when conceptualized the app, STD rates had just hit an all-time high in the U.S. now for five consecutive years in a row. It was basically an answer to the fact that the dating apps have really made casual sex much more accessible and accepted. And, you know, one of the unintended consequences of that is just these increased STD rates. So this seemed like a real logical, simple solution to it. We launched it about 5 years ago. We've rebranded it since to Safely. At the time, I thought it was going to be this really simple, quick thing. We'd build it and sell it off to one of the dating apps. And little did I know how disjointed, the electronic health record systems in the U.S. were, right? How sort of bifurcated and non-interoperable. And this was at the very early stages of the ONC pushing for interoperability standards, which ultimately FHIR is what most of the big EHRs, and I think now there's pretty much unanimous sort of agreement that should be the file data model standard. But that was really the key feature, right? We needed to figure out how to let people import the recent STD test results for free from anywhere. And that was sort of the initial challenge that we had to face. And, what we realized is there was no silver bullet. And we now have that as a core component, an enabling foundational level system within our broader platform now is integrations with all of the EHRs and we're part of and integrated with the largest national HIEs, the health information exchanges. So that we can pull patient records in and then also push data back out to enable continuity of care. But that really was that feature, that now really developed hardened system, the original impetus for it was really just to let people, access a sort of tamper-proof digital workflow for proving their STD testing status.
Got it. And then how did you evolve from there into more connected care, at-home diagnostics, and telehealth, and become a platform for others to use?
Yeah. So, basically the first challenge was how do we let people import their recent test results to show it? That was the hook, right? That was the free use case and something really simple. And you have, millions of people out there that are, carrying around on a screenshot on their phone of their test results. But if you go to Google and you want to see something super alarming, search for fake STD test, right? And there's dozens of sites that allow you to make just that. Right. And not that people are trying to cover up chronic infections, but it's like they get caught off guard. They're going on a hookup. It's 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So that was really step one. Then we said, okay, now we need to provide an easy and expensive way to get tested. Right. And we want to have insurance cover because all insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the commercial payers cover STD testing. And it's fairly expensive for a 6-panel test. The CMS rates are around $350. Total for like a seven test panel. And you have, options for at home, like Everly Well and stuff like that. But even those are $200, $250, right? And it's all out of pocket. Health and none of those, at home testing solutions are currently reimbursable. So what we realized then is we need to requisition these tests as medically necessary by a licensed clinician in order to have them covered. Right. And then we also needed to have integrations with the reference labs like Quest and LabCorp in order to have, thousands of locations that people can book the testing, in their local area. Right. So the first step is we went and we forged partnerships with Quest and LabCorp. We did these very intensive sort of HL7 interfaces with their backend systems for orders and results and scheduling, which, over a year to not only do the HL7 integrations, but then get them certified through a very intensive process. So now we have integrations and we've got 6,000 locations that people can schedule testing. Now we needed the providers to requisition.
So right.
We then set out and built a national healthcare practice and brought in, physicians that were licensed across all 50 states. that could be used to requisition the tests and then triage the positive test cases, right? Because if you order the test, you now have a responsibility if it comes back positive for chlamydia to make sure that that person gets a follow-up in a timely way, and then ultimately a treatment plan, generally a prescription, right? So we built out that part, and you know that was challenging in itself to set up a national professional medical corporation, and so we overcame all of that. And then we said, look, it's actually not efficient to do traditional telehealth, synchronous telehealth, just to requisition tests. So we then built a system for basically creating what we call virtual consults, so questionnaires that mimic the dialogue you'd have with your doctor at the point of care, right? And then the answers to those questions are reviewed by a clinician that's licensed in the state where the user is. And their NPI, their license, is used to requisition the test as medically necessary. And then ultimately, when the results come back in, they're reviewed by, again, a clinician that's licensed in the state where the user is. And if they're positive, they follow up and triage with a prescription. But so then in order to pull all that off, we had to build what we now call the assisted care automation engine, which basically lets us codify the protocols for in-person doctor visit, right, into these virtual consults. And we also then needed to tie in with SureScripts to handle the e-prescribing part of it. And then we needed, again, the EHR integrations. We utilized that to push the records back into the patient's main health record to ensure continuity of care. So a lot of these features and functionality that we've now are on version 2 or version 3 in terms of iterations of improving and making them more scalable for us really started just out of necessity with this one little sort of what we thought going to be this very, very simple.
Yeah, solving your own problem.
Yeah. So what we did we met Mayo Clinic, the Mayo Ventures team, I guess mid-2019, and explained to them that, hey, this is what we've built so far. We want to take a step back and actually create a platform that makes it quick and easy to create these type of population health apps, right? Yep. You look at NERX, Roman, Hims, Livongo, kind of the first round of what are being called pop health apps. And, they cost, millions of dollars and several years to get to market. If you look at overall software development success rate trends, probably 80% that tried to make it to market failed, right? So what we did is we said, okay, what's really needed in the market to take advantage of this new sort of semi-automated virtual first care model models is basically a Shopify for digital health apps. And that's really what we built now is we leverage all those core systems and integrations into the existing, national healthcare infrastructure and basically abstracted it into a low to no code solution that makes it really fast and easy to stand up really specialized, digital health apps that can be, very easily configured or white labeled to service the specific needs of different populations or use cases. So that's how it kind of evolved to where we're at now.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's kind of full stack and all parts included and all people included that you would need to do things like the consults and the requisitions. Who do you think your platform is, or what use cases do you think your platform is more purpose-built for today or to enable today?
Well, I mean, anybody who's looking to remove friction from a clinical workflow or reduce cost. And really increase accessibility. So, a real hot topic lately has been, health equity and people who don't have transportation and how do you move those clinical services into the home? Another big one is you look at the telehealth industry and, population health apps that have been coming out and they really hold the promise to substantially reduce cost and increase accessibility. They're missing one critical element, right? Even the 800-pound gorillas in the telehealth space, like Teladoc and Doctor on Demand, don't have any at-home testing capabilities integrated into them. So, part of our platform, you know, on one side is the sort of Shopify of digital health apps, where very quickly stand up these kind of turnkey custom solutions. The other side of it, an SDK, an orders and results interface, that enables telehealth providers to basically add connected home testing capabilities to their service offering, right? And it fills a big gap in their service offering today, but it also really expands the scope of care scenarios that they can service, where they're very limited now, right? Care scenarios that either don't require testing or that they can kind of get away with skipping the testing, right? Which is really fundamentally causing some problems in a lot of ways, sort of violates antibiotic stewardship. Because what's happening, if you were to call telehealth right now and say, you know, I think I have strep throat or, you know, a UTI, is they will just prescribe the antibiotics without doing the testing that's part of the commonly accepted clinical protocol at the point of care, right? So antibiotic stewardship and Hippocratic Oath aside, they're also alienated from this very large revenue stream that their point of care counterparts enjoy, you know, point of care testing, $83 billion in the U.S. last year. So there's a lot of interest from that group, and we're very close to completing that SDK, and we're working now integrating the first couple partners, which you know, will be enabled with these, you know, the CDX connected home testing capability.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So, I mean, that would be a huge, unique selling proposition for your platform, right? Is just you greatly expand the number of scenarios that you can treat and businesses that you can build around those at-home diagnostics. I'm curious on the reimbursement side, how that is handled for different flavors of at-home diagnostics. Like, are they all covered as long as you go through certain protocols, or are there gray areas? And how does your platform help adopters navigate that?
So there is some gray area there now. And you know, one of them, just taking COVID testing as an example, you look at the Lucira COVID flu test, right? It's a rapid molecular test. It's got $142 CMS reimbursement rate at the point of care, right? So if you walk into your doctor and they have a Lucira test that they bought for $50 and actually swab your nose and run it there at the point of care, they can get reimbursement from commercial payers or Medicare or Medicaid, no problem, right? Then if you look at Same Day Health or one of these home nursing testing services, right? The nurse comes to your door, swabs your nose, sits in her car and runs it, puts it into their, you know, EHR through her phone. That's okay to file, right? That's a point of care test, and you just put the modifier place of service at home. So what we're now engaged with CMS and HHS discussing is, can you utilize telehealth as the equivalent of that place of service at home? Why do you need that sort of nurse coming to the door and swabbing your nose and sitting in her car? Isn't it the same or even better to do it through a clinician connected directed process through a CDX enabled app? And you know, the inclination there is that it's the answer is yes. It is. So you know, we're working through that now, and we're working with McDermott, who's the largest you know, healthcare attorney out there. They have a consulting group called McDermott Plus that is like a, you know, basically lobbyists as part of what they do. They were the ones that lobbied Congress to get the reimbursement mandate for the 8 COVID tests a month. And later, Congress didn't feel they had purview to require CMS to reimburse that. But then McDermott Plus then went through the at-home testing coalition that they organized to CMS and got CMS to approve that as well.
Got it. And then, I mean, one question about, you know, everyone being able to kind of administer their own tests at home and send it off. is just the like the usability and the instructions. And I noticed on your guys's website, it looks like you've put a lot of intention behind really explaining how to do different at-home tests. Can you talk around that and like, you know, what are some of the challenges maybe that people face and how as an application or platform experience you guys are dealing with that?
Yeah, so there's a couple answers to that. So, I mean, first, taking a step back, there's really two different types of tests or three different types of tests that are supported by the platform. The first is a return to lab test kit, right? That's you collect at home, you put it in the box. We're integrated with FedEx. You either drop it at a FedEx or FedEx will come and pick it up. It gets sent to a reference lab and then resulted back into these sort of semi-automated clinical workflows, you know, in an app powered by our platform, right? So that's the Everlywell Let's Get Check model. People are pretty familiar with that. We're enhancing that by connecting it into clinical workflows to enable reimbursement. The first place that we're really pushing that out will be in California, the second half of this year, around STD testing. California passed a law in 2021 requiring commercial payers and CMS or Medicaid to reimburse at-home STD test kits, return to lab test kits. And that law went into effect last year, and we're now working with payers in California to enable them with solutions to actually abide by, you know, that law, to implement those workflows. So kind of back to one of your questions earlier, you know, who are some of the customers or some of the use cases? We really see payers as being a really big beneficiary of this platform because it reduces costs and increases accessibility to routine care and chronic disease management workflows for their members. And they stand to save not, you know, millions of dollars, but billions of dollars, you know, by semi-automating some of these workflows and moving some of these tests into the home. And for instance, you know, they're reimbursing now for an average seven, you know, test STD panel around $350 to $400 in the current way that happens when it goes into a clinic or goes into their primary care physician, whereas that could be done for under $200 using this model. So that's the return to lab bucket. The second is rapid lateral flow tests, right? And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I would have used the example of a pregnancy test, right? But now you can use COVID antigen tests as the example. So currently, you just look at the results, right? And you could maybe tell your doctor or whatever, but they can't use that. Those aren't clinically reliable results if they're conveyed by you, right? You also can't use it for international travel or other things like that because you know, they're just being conveyed. So we have a technology that we call the Universal RDT Reader. It is a regulated software as a medical device. We submitted it to the FDA last year as an EUA. And at the end of the year, they asked us to submit it as a 510K, which is a permanent filing. The debate there with the FDA that went back and forth for almost a year was the predicate devices, Healthy.io and ScanWell, which are associated with a UTI test. They were filed as a UTI test, which, by the way, have a digital read, right? Whereas what we proposed to the FDA that was in the best interest of the public good was for them to approve our universal RDT reader. They can read any rapid diagnostic lateral flow test. And it's basically a computer vision AI. So you hold your phone over, when it gets the right tilt and distance, it automatically takes an image of the cassette, and then it sends it to this cloud service where a computer vision AI machine learning model interprets it and returns clinically reliable results, you know, again, into that automated, you know, clinical workflow. So what we proposed and what we, you know, really were sort of trying to get the FDA to wrap their heads around was the idea of approving it as software as a medical device platform, right? It could read any test. So rather than tightly coupling our clinical study data to a particular test, we define the clinical study protocol for validating the efficacy of the digital read for a particular test. That way we can onboard lots of different tests quickly.
Got it.
They don't have to all be separate 510K filings. It could be a supplement against an existing 510K, adding the digital read that references, you know, all the sort of meat and potatoes or detailed stuff on the AI interpretation that's embodied in our 510K. So we were invited into an accelerated review process, and we expect that to be approved. Currently, we have it running in self-assessment mode. So what it does, it's the same process I just described, except the addition of a button where the end user does their personal interpretation, and then all of that information is given to the provider when they review, asynchronously review, or, you know, with a synchronous telehealth consult. They have the AI interpretation, the end user, the patient's interpretation, and then a photo, you know, of it, so that they're informed and can make clinical decisions based on those
Got it. And then the idea is, once FDA approves, that the machine learning algorithm will be able to classify the result properly without any of that kind of self-identification of the result. And then that will be clinically accepted and reimbursable.
Exactly. And that's, you know, the way we designed it is, you know, we have a sort of AI training SOP that's part of, you know, this process. So we capture about 1,000 photos. The AI then makes millions of copies with slight permutations, which is used as a training set. And, you know, so there's ultimately a validation process for each test. And then we're now working with test developers to onboard their tests and validate them on the platform. So there'll be a growing compendium of, you know, CDX enabled tests that are available either, you know, through our platform with the custom apps or available through this SDK, so that telehealth providers and even through EHR interfaces we're working on now, point of care providers can all sort of order these CDX tests and have them resulted back to that encounter record in the ordering provider's instance of their EHR.
Right. That's exciting. How about other types of technology? So AI, machine learning, clear use case for your platform. How do you support the, like, let's say, remote physiological monitoring or patient monitoring or telemedicine for improving patient outcomes?
So we implemented a third-party SDK that's kind of like a Zapier of Bluetooth interfaces for mobile health devices. So basically, we currently support about 600 different devices, but we're now going out and actually partnering with select device manufacturers, both on the IVD side, where, again, we sort of enable their rapid in vitro diagnostic tests, right? You know, UTI, HIV, STD, PSA, drugs of abuse. There's a whole number of those on the IVD side. But now we're also working with actual medical device manufacturers to add things like EKG, blood ox, thermometer scales to support RPM models and also to sort of enhance those virtual consults, right? So you can have something that says input your temperature, your weight. So we have that as part of the virtual consults now. And you, you know, slide a slider with your finger, you enter the information. But now you can actually say, okay, I'm using this scale, and the scale or the blood ox or, you know, blood pressure cuff will just sit wirelessly transmit that biometric data. We're also integrated with, you know, with the Apple Watch and the Android based watches, so that you can send biometric data from, you know, those wearables into these clinical workflows.
That's great, because it makes the consult more convenient for everyone, more accurate for everyone. And then I think eventually those observations of the RPM will be reimbursable as well.
And those are now. I mean, the whole point of remote patient monitoring is it's remote. So those are all very solidified. And there are some tests, like I said, with California, they just passed a law with the STD return to lab. We have been getting reimbursements. Several of our customers that are have kind of white labeled solutions have been getting reimbursed at the $34 rate for the rapid molecular tests, right?
Okay.
And what we tend to call it is, I mean, COVID confused things a little bit with this OTC designation. So, you know, over the counter, I mean, we see these tests being sold over the counter, but you can only use them in conjunction with a clinician connected directed process through a CDX enabled app. Again, one that's created on our platform using kind of the Shopify digital health app functionality, or, you know, through Teladoc or Doctor on Demand, maybe Cedar Sinai's app that's powered by Amwell, their telehealth app. So, you know, the idea is that if you want to utilize the results of the test to get a treatment plan, presumably a prescription, right, and you want it to be reimbursed, you'll have to use it and scan it and use it as part of one of these workflows. What's exciting is we were awarded a multi-year contract from HHS last year.
Okay.
Basically help them and the federal government define standards and set up infrastructure to enable a connected home testing system as part of the national healthcare infrastructure. And part of that is open sourcing components of our platform and setting up a reference instance for HHS, you know, that will basically enable any application developer to add CDX capabilities, you know, to their applications. And it's all based on Web 3.0 technologies and microservices, open API, so that, you know, you can really enable not only applications to register themselves and enable communication between end users, say a patient and a provider, but also machine-to-machine communication, which is where things really interesting and what the ecosystem, you know, the current healthcare ecosystem is lacking, is that sort of coordination layer that acts as kind of connective tissue.
Right. That's great. So you guys have a platform now, and you're open sourcing some of these components and really helping guide HHS, right, and allowing other people to kind of build up their own solutions and platforms. But of course, you guys will always be kind of the AWS managed version of all of these things too.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, that's really the point. I mean, we can come in and accelerate it, but I mean, we don't want to just keep this to ourselves. I mean, it's important that, you know, in order to facilitate all the advantages of, you know, connected home care, right?
Yeah.
Not only in the cost savings, but again, the accessibility and health equity and
absolutely, you know,
the reduction in costs is also going to allow for the money that is allocated to a particular condition, right? Like, you know, even take like, you know, prostate cancer or cervical cancer, right? And soon we'll live in a world where it'll be the norm to do a genetic screening, right? And you'll know and probably not so distant future where you feel irresponsible as a parent not to have a genetic screening for your newborn baby when they get their vaccinations, right? Like, why wouldn't you want to know their
risks,
biological data, right? And the risks that they have. And if you know that they've got a gene mutation that could be cause a predisposition to a certain type of cancer, and you know that catching that cancer early is going to make it much more treatable, right? You know, you're going to want to monitor it frequently, right? But the cost of those tests right now and having to go to the point of care to do them really doesn't allow for that. But if you could do 50 tests for the price of what it costs a payer to do just one now, then the payer's going to be like, fine, you know, go ahead and do 30. That's still a cost savings for us. And it's better for us because we'll be able to catch, you know, the onset of these disease states earlier, which makes them not only more treatable, which is obviously good for the patient, but also less expensive to treat, which is good for the payer.
So yeah, no, I think you're right.
A fundamental shift in the thinking of how we approach, you know, disease monitoring and certainly cut a lot of fat off of these just ultra common routine care and chronic disease management scenarios that are just handled in a way that's inefficient today.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. I think the cost of the system, that's a huge impact. And then also on the consumer side, I don't know how many times, myself included, I've been stopped from getting a consultation or a diagnostic because I just don't want to take that time to go in to a point of care or have a less comfortable conversation with someone I don't really know, in a health system. And I think, yeah, like the STD case, for example, that's very sensitive. And I'm sure so many people are blocked from getting tested just because they have their own stigma for going in and talking to a person about that potential. So I think, yeah, you hit the nail on the head as far as, okay, macro level, it's the cost, but for the consumer, really that accessibility and convenience and willingness, right, to go ahead and get the care or checkups that they need.
It's true. It's true. One of the, I think, important things that we've done with the platform, we talk a lot about the CDX, the connected diagnostics system. And that is a fundamental thing. Like, we need to enable connected care with diagnostics in the home that's integrated and actually part of the clinical workflow. And we're starting there, and we were really focused on it. But I think the idea of care automation and applying workflow engine, decision engine technology, as we've done to these care workflows, is something that the time has come, right? I mean, these technologies are very baked at this point. They've been applied incredibly successfully to supply chain management, manufacturing, dealing with incredibly complex things. I mean, imagine all the components inside this iPhone, right? All needed to be shipped to a factory, and all needed to be put together in a certain way, and then billions of these needed to be moved all around the world, and everything tracked. And and now imagine applying the same technology that drives that from, like, ServiceNow, for instance, right? And we did recently bring on the former chief architect at ServiceNow, is now our chief architect, and that says a
Great.
lot, because it shows where we're focused. You imagine all that complexity that I just meant, and how robust that those technologies are. Now, look at applying that to the protocol for prostate cancer screening, right? And I just use this one example. There's, a guy over 50, has his primary care, annual checkup, and he has a high PSA level. That's a prostate cancer marker. Prostate cancer is very slow-moving cancer, and the protocol for that, assuming it's not off the charts high, is to monitor it, right? Twice a year, screen for the rest of their life. Currently, that guy, at 50-year-old guy, for the next 40 years, has to take off work twice a year and go into the point of care and get a test that costs around $400 that payers are reimbursing, right? In Europe, there's a lateral flow PSA test that costs about $2.50, and we're working with that manufacturer, that test developer, right? With our platform, you can establish what we call a care automation protocol that would be authored by whoever the world expert urologist in prostate cancer is, right? And what it defines is basically each step in a clinical protocol. So with this one, it's okay, monitor this patient by doing a PSA screening twice a year. So every January 15th and July 15th, a PSA test is automatically drop shipped from an integrated 3PL. The patient then gets annoyed with text reminders until they take the test, take the 10 minutes to take the test and scan it. If the levels are normal, the process just continues. If they cross a pre-programmed threshold that the urologist authored into that care automation protocol, it automatically sets up an appointment for a biopsy. If you talk to any urologist, they'll tell you after year two or three, there's almost 100% drop off in adherence of coming in that second time a year to get tested. And the difference of coming in that second time could be the difference of that prostate cancer metastasizing and spreading into your bones or your lymph nodes, and going from something that was incredibly treatable, right? Just pull out your prostate to, oh my God, I'm now getting chemo and have a risk of very short lifespan, right? That process that I just mentioned can be done for about a quarter of the current price. And there's no burnout from the provider. The provider's not having to deal with mundane stuff that algorithms are much better suited to handle.
Got it. Got it. And then, gosh, I mean, it seems like, you know, your vision of this type of, you know, workflow and automation and at-home diagnostics, you're very well positioned in this market. What is your commercial strategy?
So our commercial strategy is essentially to partner with large players in the industry and provide PaaS solutions. So platform as a service solutions. And the way we architected the platform is we could provide someone like Cardinal, right, who's one of the biggest med-surg and pharmaceutical distributors. And we actually recently brought on the retired CEO, Mike Kaufman of Cardinal, is now on our board of directors. So a company like Cardinal that's already servicing, you know, thousands and thousands of, you know, private practices, independent pharmacies, could basically, we could provide them a solution that, you know, say a virtual pharmacy solution, right, that would allow independent pharmacies to have a hybrid virtual physical type care scenarios. And through deregulation, pharmacists can now requisition tests and even prescribe a number of different medications. At the same time, they're under a barrage from population health and digital enabled competitors, right? Capsule, Truepill, Nurx, Roman Hims. I mean, they're all like eating away at the independent pharmacist, because if you're getting your ED medication, right, through Hims, you're not going into your local pharmacy where you used to go pick it up. Right. That's a lost patient, a lost script for them. So, you know, there is a real demand, a real need for that. So rather than us having to go out to 10,000 pharmacies, we'd enable an entity like Cardinal, right, that already has those relationships, is already selling products and services, in some cases already SaaS software. They would then go enabled by a PaaS solution, you know, platform as a service solution that we give them, to then go offer a SaaS solution to their existing customers.
Got it.
You know, another example is with payers. So we're in discussions with a number of payers around basically solving pain points or areas of cost reduction that's possible by, you know, either semi-automating or moving the care scenario into the home. So we see payers as a big, you know, beneficiary of the platform. You know, another is employers. You know, there's more and more self-insured employers, and, you know, for the first time, you really have entrepreneurial minded, people that have a say in the plan design, right? Because when you say self-insured employers, it's not like they're actually handling the insurance. It's your typical insurance providers like United or Aetna are actually behind the scenes doing the actuary tables and the actual insurance. It's just the company pays into that plan, and for that, they have a little bit of, you know, say in the design of the plan. And, you know, their objective isn't just provide the care services at the lowest cost so the actuary table margins work out right. They also have the added, you know, challenge or desire not only to reduce costs, but to reduce out-of-work time when an employee or a family member gets sick or is dealing with a chronic infection, right? So now they're looking at, how do we have preventative care, right? How do we not only treat this UTI, but do it in 30 minutes as opposed to having to take a half a day off work? Or when this employee who's a single mom's kid gets strep throat for the third time in third grade, you know, how do we have her deal with that at home without having to take off work, drive across town, sit in a germ-infested waiting room, potentially getting sick herself, all just to deal with her kid's, you know, strep throat, right? So we really see self-insured employers as being big drivers of innovation, because ultimately they'll prove out these cost savings and efficiencies and have the discretion and really the wherewithal and desire to try these new things. And then that'll ultimately prove to the commercial payers, hey, let's integrate these, you know, concepts into our commercial plans, right? And then ultimately CMS, who will probably be the slowest adopter, just, you know, being the government, you know, we'll have a lot of sort of proof points and market data to either encourage or almost force them through Congress to adopt, you know, more efficient methodologies like that.
Right. That's exciting. Yeah, I know. And I guess that's the big benefit of being a platform, or as you mentioned, like a platform as a service. Normally, if a startup was saying, oh, well, we can be used by providers or payers or someone targeting independent pharmacies or governments, right, you would tell them, oh, well, you're crazy to target all of those. But if you have a platform that really has all of those building blocks that authentically can be built up to serve all of those cases and packages as a platform, not a SaaS, then you can do that, right? And it actually makes sense too.
It's funny because you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we went out talking to, you know, your typical Silicon Valley, you know, funds about the, we pretty much uniformly got, you're not focused. And what was funny is, you know, and I respect a lot of these people that told us that and that we got no's right. from. Luckily, we did $102 million in revenue last year. We generated about $35 million in gross profit. So we just kind of, you know, used non-dilutive, profit to basically, which we pretty much reinvested entirely into product development and engineering. Because at the end of the day, we are a computer science, you know, platform company. And we got that feedback, including from very, very smart people that just didn't get what you just, you know, very quickly understood in that they're like, you need to focus in this condition or this area or this customer category. And the answer was always why. We've built something incredibly flexible that with, now hundreds and hundreds of settings in a matter of hours can be configured just as easily to deal with breast cancer recovery as toenail fungus. Right. Or a solution for payers as a university, right? A independent pharmacy or a private, you know, physician practice. Right. And there really is no difference to us in terms of how we architected the platform. And that's why we see, you know, the opportunity isn't up here at the surface. We really see ourselves being infrastructure, you know, layers below. And why we're now open sourcing and making SDKs so that you don't even have to use applications built on our platform. We can give it to Teladoc and to NERCS and Roman, HIMSS, Livongo, integrated into EHRs so that point of care providers can order connected home tests the same way they order, you know, tests from Quest and LabCorp now, right? That are just instead of being resulted back from a lab information system at a centralized lab in LIS, it's just being resulted back from your phone.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah, and it's interesting that you got that feedback from the, you know, the Valley and the Sandhill types of investors. But what I just learned about is your journey as an entrepreneur, where, you know, actually you didn't start with the platform as a service. You started with your own problem around STDs, and you ended up building into a SaaS and then into a flexible platform, right? So you didn't start with this grand notion that could, you know, only be achieved if people bought it. It's like you solved your own problem. You realized that it could solve many other problems and built a platform around that. Last question for you, Ken, is, I mean, I think your entrepreneurial journey is fascinating, and all of the different, companies and pivots and building blocks that you've built to this point of being very successful. Do you have any advice for other entrepreneurs in digital health or otherwise?
I mean, it's funny, and we've been discussing this a lot. I have a partner who's worth pointing out. He isn't, you know, officially a co-founder because he came on about, a year or so after we founded the company. But I look at him that way, and I put him on the board. It's our CTO, Demi Jeannot, I constantly have people, oh, you're a visionary. And it may be so on the business side, but I mean, he's really the technical visionary that's made this a reality. And it has taken, you know, since that first proof of concept single app, we had this sort of build and destroy iterative sort of model. We built the first prototype of that. By the time it got ready to launch and we launched it, the code was so bloated because we were figuring out how to build it as we went along, right? And you don't want to do that. It's the worst thing you can do with software. So we had two versions of that just in the proof of concept when it was just an app, not a platform for creating apps. And we're now microservice by microservice rolling out really the third iteration of the actual platform version of it. And it's been really interesting because him and I both approach things differently in on one way in the way we think about things, okay. but also have a passion for abstracting problems. And you know,
right.
I look up to Elon and say what you will about him and mm-hmm. this and that, but, mm-hmm. but that guy, his heart is in the right place. And mm-hmm. you know, to bring it, you know, back to your question, I think what one of the things for two of the main components of his success, one is mm-hmm. that he breaks things down to first principle, as he calls it. And that's what I was, okay. you know, just sort of getting to with Dimi,
right.
And how him and I think and how we've approached building this level of flexibility, which, you know, most people can't, you know, comprehend, let alone figure out how to actually architect and then code and bring to life.
Right.
It is because we take every challenge and we break it down to what is its first principle? What is the fundamental of this problem? And I think a lot of entrepreneurs and, you know, certainly mm-hmm. software engineers and architects look at it at the problem level, right? Or maybe even the mm-hmm. causality mm-hmm. of the problem. But getting into the root causality that might cause the thing that causes the problem, like you really right. have to break it down to its most fundamental building block. I mean, kind of what they're doing in CERN, trying to figure out what is the most fundamental building block of a subatomic particle, right? It's like, right. there's an atom. Everything's made of atoms. Well, what's inside of that? A nucleus. What's inside of that? What's inside of that? What's inside of that? And I think that's kind of important sort of advice, and it's across industries. It really doesn't matter what you're working on, but if you don't know what those foundation principles are, mm-hmm. you're not going to build the right thing, right? You're going to build on a level above where you should be thinking or starting.
Got it.
And then finally, it's really just, again, back to, you know, something that I think Elon personifies, and that is having mm-hmm. your guidepost, like having your objective, your mission, what it is that you're trying to accomplish, always clear and insight. Mm-hmm. And if you just use that as your sort of barometer, as you're just, you know, being hit with crazy winds and snows and machine gun fire and mortars and all the stuff that it takes to build a company, you always have this sort of guiding light to keep you going in the right direction. Because it's easy to lose track when you're in the jungle and you're taking machine gun fire and mortars and
right.
investors are telling you this, your board's telling you that, mm-hmm. your customers yelling at you for that, and your friends suggesting this. And, you know, it's hard to not lose sight of where you're going mm-hmm. or to get pushed off course. And because it's a long journey, every time you're pushed off course a little bit, you have to course correct, right? You're taking a lot more energy and capital to do it. So the more yeah. you can follow a straight line towards what your objective is, I think that's really important. And I think having a mission that's bigger than your yeah. commercial outcome that you're looking for really helps to effectuate or operationalize that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think that's great advice, Ken. And, you know, I could tell you broke it down into first principle and then had your mission. And when other people told you that mission was too big, you said, no, it's not. And I'm going to show you. And you've done that. And that's awesome. So, Ken, it's been a pleasure having you on the pod. I'm a huge fan of what you're doing. Just learned a whole lot more of what you're doing. And really agree that platforms like yours that are key to making quality care more accessible. And to do that, we have to bring more care to the patients. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. Take it easy.
All right, thanks. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks for listening to this podcast and being a part of this movement. This podcast is brought to you by Persimmon Health, an offering by Leapfrog Technology that's purpose-built to help innovators imagine, build, and scale digital health products. We're passionate about fixing healthcare and have worked on over 50 digital health products. If you want to share your story or want to work together, please shoot an email to hello@persimmonhealth.com. Thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you on the next podcast.